Ballard's Mill. Tuesday, December 1. One of the great cedar doors to the mill stands ajar, and a large bay mare is tied to the post outside. I don't hear the expected sounds of saw and hatchet within, but rather the muted strain of conversation. So I stop outside the door and tip my head to one side, listening. The horse whickers, and I set a hand on its nose, urging silence so I can hear what is being said.
I've already completed that survey, my husband argues, and I have 3 lumber orders to fill by next Friday. I don't have time to do it again.
I have been married long enough to catch the nuance in Ephraim's voice, every clipped syllable and strained vowel, and there is no doubt he is struggling to control his temper.
The Kennebec proprietors want it done again.
Ah, Joseph North. I press my lips together and give the horse an accusing stare. Traitor. Then pull my hand away from the soft, warm nose and slide closer to the door. Ephraim clears his throat.
Doing it again won't change the results. They might beg to differ. They can beg all they like, but they've not seen the land. It's nothing but bog for miles in every direction, unsuitable for farming. And besides, right now, it's little more than a block of ice. They want to assign a lease on the property and doom their tenants to a life of failure and poverty?
A drawer rattles and papers shuffle. I can hear the warning note in my husband's voice grow sharper.
Here, the survey. I was there 2 months ago. I assume you filed the last copy I gave you.
Not yet.
I hear the crinkle of paper as North straightens the map and then folds it again.
I can't. Can't or won't. It's not what they're expecting. And you know they have expectations, Ephraim. I am not leaving my family in the dead of winter to confirm something I already know.
Ephraim's voice is now low and smooth and deceptively calm.
Besides, I know what you're doing, Joseph. I am reminding you of your obligation.
North lightens the tone of his voice, cajoles.
You like this lease, don't you? You like living here?
Ephraim doesn't answer, and there is wariness in that stretch of silence.
This land is leased to you by our mutual employers. The Kennebec proprietors can be quite generous when they're pleased with a tenant. I think you've experienced that yourself over the last 11 years. You have the lease and the surveying contract, but not the deed to this mill. Not yet.
The Kennebec proprietors, a part of the Plymouth Company in Boston, acquired vast land holdings along the Kennebec Valley 150 years ago. They own most of the land along the river for 15 miles on either side and have been leasing it out to encourage settlement in the District of Maine. Our family assumed the lease on Ballard's Mill 11 years ago, but do not yet own the deed. That won't happen until next April, when we finally meet the third condition. The first two were met within a year of living here, building a home and tilling a minimum of 5 acres. The last, however, is a matter of time. We must live on this property for 12 consecutive years before it can become legally ours. So we are in breach of nothing. Yet I can feel the threat hanging in the air between North and my husband.
I remember the terms of our lease well enough. You don't have to remind me. Don't I? Because you seem strangely unwilling to see reason. Is one survey worth losing both your home and your income? You want me to falsify my findings? To claim it's habitable land? I want you to understand there are bigger things at stake. Without the mill and your contract, you'd find your family in a dire situation.
North pauses for a moment, and I would give anything to see his expression.
It is, as you mentioned, the dead of winter.
He has delivered his orders, but won't stand around to watch Ephraim mull over the decision. Boots shift impatiently on the worn plank floor. And since I don't want to be caught eavesdropping, I step around the door and into the mill. I say the first thing that comes to mind. Have you seen my ink? I smile at my husband, then make a show of being startled by North's presence. At his feet lies a mongrel, half mutt, some indeterminate breed that's been bastardized a dozen times over, and half coyote. He is brown and black and white with tall peaked ears, a long snout, and yellow eyes. He sees me and growls. There is a rustling in the loft, and I tilt my chin to see Percy, perched on the rail, rousing his feathers. His talons pulse like a man flexing his fingers in anticipation. The bird likes neither the dog nor the growl, and from the way those hackles rise in response along the bony ridge of the cur's spine, I can see the feeling is mutual.
Hush, Cicero,
North orders, looking first at the falcon, then at the dog. After a moment, his gaze returns to me, and he says,
sit.
Cicero obeys because he must, but keeps his teeth bared. I remain standing with my arms crossed because I will not be told what to do by the likes of Joseph North. Your dog has poor manners, I tell him.
Or good judgment.
He tips his hat, but his voice is cold, and his eyes are slanted, hateful.
Martha.
Ephraim notes the exchange with a narrowed gaze. Joseph North is a genteel man, not typically given to rudeness, and I doubt my husband will tolerate another snide comment. I do not return the greeting. North wants an apology for disrupting his court last week, but he won't get one.
There, Ephraim says, nodding toward the drafting table where a small wooden box is spread open. Your ink.
My quill lays flat beside the box, the tip blackened by Ephraim's morning scribbles. Beside the writing paraphernalia is a neatly stacked pile of woodworking tools, knives and blades of various lengths. One of them, Ephraim's favorite, is a wicked, hook-shaped thing used for stripping small branches off felled trees. A bottle of linseed oil and a polishing rag sit beside it, abandoned. The mill smells of frost and sawdust, oiled metal, and old leather. It smells like Ephraim. Where two discs of ink are usually nestled, only one remains. Ephraim crosses the floor and slides a protective arm around my waist, and I relax as his thumb strokes my ribcage.
This is your ink?
North asks, lifting a hand. It is only then that I notice the hardened disc pinched between his thumb and forefinger, the pads of which are now stained black.
Ephraim never told me that you draw.
I open my mouth to answer, but Ephraim grabs the back of my dress in his fist and pulls me closer in warning. So I shrug one shoulder instead.
I suppose it comes in handy. You must need pictures of your herbs. Speaking of which, North adds, I believe my wife will stop by for another tonic soon. Her headaches have gotten worse of late.
I have never drawn a picture in my life, and I certainly don't need one to help me remember that Lydia North requires a concoction of dried feverfew, peppermint, and ginger, combined with crushed rosemary and yarrow. It only works when I soak the herbs in brandy for 60 days, however. The result is an effective tincture that I try to keep on hand. But if Lydia's debilitating headaches have gotten worse, I blame North and all he's put her through in recent months. Regardless, his cavalier assumption that I will play nursemaid to his wife has me gnawing on the edge of my tongue. After a prolonged silence, North turns to my husband.
I'll be expecting your survey at the end of the month.
And with that, he strides out the door and swings onto his horse. The dog trots after him obediently. Ephraim lets go of my dress and picks up the hooked blade from his work table. He taps the flat against his palm as the sound of hooves retreats into the distance. More so than anything else on the workbench,
That instrument looks like a thing built to maim.
The rogue has lived too long, he mutters under his breath,
and brings the blade down onto the drafting table in a neat arc. It lodges there, quivering, and swath of pale wood gleams beneath the cleaved board like an open wound. I peer at him, skeptical.
You've been reading Shakespeare again.
He shrugs, then yanks the blade free.
I like the way he delivers an insult.
Then surely you can do better than that for a man such as North. I love my husband's smile. It transforms his stoic face, revealing two rows of straight teeth and laugh lines around his eyes.
That clay-brained guts. That naughty, pated fool. That whoreson, obscene, greasy tallowcatch.
Well, I say, your clay-brained, greasy whoreson took my ink. How do you plan on getting it back?
He tosses the knife onto the table. I'll buy you more.
That thing looks like revenge to me, I tell him.
What?
Your knife.
That's not a bad name for a blade.
He picks it up again, balances its weight in his palm, then brings it down onto the table once more.
Revenge it is.
After a moment, Ephraim turns back to the wide double doors that North passed through and frowns.
Are you going to do it? I ask.
The survey? I overheard your conversation. He scratches behind one ear.
I don't think I have much choice.
You realize he's punishing us for what I did in court?
Yes, but I think there's more to it than that.
How so?
North wants me to be hundreds of miles away when it comes time for you to testify.
Why?
Because the law of coverture prevents a woman from testifying in court without her husband present.
No, I shake my head. I give testimony in court many times a year without you being present.
Only because your profession allows you to do so regarding a woman's declaration of paternity during childbirth. Those parameters do not extend to a situation like this.
But if I'm not able to testify next month,
Rebecca Foster will lose her only witness, and her allegations will be dismissed, he says.
Mill Creek Bridge, Friday, December 4.
Goodbye, love.
Ephraim tucks his face into the crook between my neck and shoulder and presses a kiss into my skin. I can feel the warmth of his breath slide beneath the collar of my dress, even as the snow falls around us. I walked with him down the lane, all the way to the bridge over Mill Creek, to say goodbye. This has been our habit through all the long years that we have lived in Hollowell. I do not let him leave without a proper send-off. Water Street spans Mill Creek by this somewhat precarious bridge. It is made of planks nailed to rough-hewn logs that rest on a series of stone foundations. Horses can cross two abreast, but wagons must go single file. There are no rails, and the drop is 15 feet to the creek below. Only 12 foot wide and 30 foot long, it often feels as though it's held together by little more than stubbornness and wishful thinking. But the bridge has ferried countless travelers across the creek for many years now, weathering flood and storm alike, and it needs little in the way of maintenance apart from having an occasional plank or log replaced. Ephraim checks the foundations every spring, after the thaw, and reinforces them where needed. You will be careful, won't you? I ask.
Of course.
And you will come home to me?
Don't I always?
Ah, but this would be the time you didn't, when I need you most. We stand beside Sterling, Ephraim's horse, at the near end of the bridge. My husband pulls away from me and tips my chin up with the edge of one finger so that our eyes meet.
What is it you're worried about?
That you won't make it home in time, that I won't be able to testify and Rebecca will be left defenseless, that North will get away with everything.
That won't happen. I will make it back.
But
I will.
He looks at the falcon who rests on the saddle swell, waiting to depart. I've taken precautions. We will be married 35 years this month. Don't start doubting me now.
Doubt and fear are not the same thing, I say, following Ephraim's gaze to Percy. The bird is hooded now, so I cannot see his penetrating burnt orange eyes. And his jesses, the long, thick leather straps round his talons, are tied to the broad ridge of leather at the front of Ephraim's saddle. He can neither see nor fly. Sometimes I feel that Percy can understand us. And perhaps he can, in his own way, because his head swivels this way and that, as though listening first to Ephraim, then to me. Percy dislikes the hood, but it is the only way to ride long distances. And only on Sterling. Brutus would never allow those lethal talons to get so close. The saddle is cross-cut with sharp, savage gashes where Percy has dug into the leather. Better it than Sterling, however. To date, the bird has never injured horse or rider, and they have all learned to tolerate the arrangement. Where will you stay? I ask.
Fort Halifax, but only at night. I can't camp in this weather. Riding back and forth to the site every day will eat up half my time. Otherwise, I could be home in a week.
A leather satchel, haversack, and a pack basket are strapped behind the cantle. They hold all of Ephraim's surveying tools and his winter gear and are packed tighter than usual given the weather and the distance he must travel. It will be a long 2 weeks for all of us. I look to the bank of clouds moving in from the east. A storm is coming.
Yes, he says. My fingers ache.
It's a bad time to travel.
I've done this before. It's only snow.
And freezing winds.
Only for a day or two, and then it will just be winter, same as always. I'm not worried, and you shouldn't be either.
I hate North for making you do this.
I hate him for so many reasons this barely ranks, he says, trying to lighten my mood.
Neither of us discuss the legitimate reasons that I have to fear, but the litany runs through my mind nonetheless. All the things that could happen to him in weather like this.
2 weeks, that's all. And then I will be home, and we will make sure North is brought to justice, he says.
I step into my husband's arms, soaking up his warmth and scent. We are in the twilight years of a long love affair, and it has recently occurred to me that a day will come when one of us buries the other. But I remind myself, that is the happy ending to a story like ours. It is a vow made and kept, till death do us part. It is the only acceptable outcome to a long and happy marriage, and I am determined not to fear that day whenever it arrives. I am equally determined to soak up all the days between. 2 weeks, I tell him, no more. He kisses my brow, the tip of my nose. My mouth, slow and gentle, making his promise with both lips and tongue.
Goodbye, love.
The animals can sense that it is time to leave. Sterling stamps his right foreleg, and Percy rouses on his perch, shaking his feathers in anticipation. They enjoy this, I think. And then Ephraim pulls away and swings into the saddle. He offers me one last smile. I stand in the snow and watch until he has crossed the bridge. I watch until he rounds the bend and is out of sight. Stop feeling sorry for yourself, I mutter, then take a deep breath and turn back toward the house. But I do not move. I do not breathe. Because there, not 20 feet away, is the silver fox. She is a beautiful specimen, a coalish kind of black, except for ears, paws, breast, and tail, all of which are white. She is perched on the crest of a snowbank, an ink stain on ivory. But it is her vivid amber eyes that hold me in thrall. They seem to penetrate me, to study me.
You again, I say,
then speak her name, my words a soft exhale, a mist in the frozen air.
Tempest.
To name a thing is a proprietary act It is a commitment of ownership or care or loyalty. It means something. With that single word, I have declared that this little beast is mine and that I have a responsibility to protect her. The sound of my voice does not frighten the animal. Instead, she takes a step forward, then two. I watch, still as carved marble, while the lithe creature approaches, each step elegant and deliberate. When she is a mere 8 feet away, I kneel to the snow and slowly extend my bare hand, palm up, in welcome. Only then does the fox startle and bolt into the woods. Sewell Chandlery, Friday, December 11. A man barges into the birthing room. He throws the door back, then flings off his coat in a single smooth movement. I see this only out of the corner of my eye, however, because my patient, young Grace Sewell, is wailing and thrashing on the bed. This is her first labor, and she fights against every pang, then sobs through every respite. We have been at it all night and are both exhausted. "Out, all of you," the man orders, and because I recognize his voice, I ignore him. I have not taken instructions in a birthing room since being apprenticed to an old rusted battle axe of a midwife in Oxford. Her name was Elspeth Horn, and everything I know about midwifery I learned from her. 30 years have passed since then, and it will take more than the likes of one presumptuous man to make me shrink back from a patient. "Did you hear me?" he asks. "Yes," I say, not turning. For the first time in 3 hours, Grace is silent. She is only startled, and it won't last long, but for the moment her mouth is shut. Miracles never cease. "Then why are you still here?" he demands. "I do not leave my patients, and I do not answer to you. This woman is no longer your patient. She is mine. I have been called in to replace you." I stand then, taking in every inch of Dr. Benjamin Page's pompous 6 feet. "And this patient of yours, do you even know her name?" I ask. "Mrs. David Sewell." "Her Christian name, doctor, the one that actually belongs to her. Do you know it?" He sniffs. "Her name is irrelevant." "Like it was irrelevant with Joshua Burgess?" I point to Grace. "You might not think a name matters in a room like this, but I assure you it is vital." I arrived at the Sewells the night before, having crossed the frozen river on foot, just before dusk. I was accompanied by the shop boy who works for David Sewell and had expected him to lead me to a private home across the street, but instead he took me right into the chandlery, where David was pacing back and forth behind the counter, looking very much like his older cousin, Henry, the town clerk. "Where is Grace?" I asked, looking around the dim store at the piles of coiled rope and barrels of oil, the shelves filled with nails and bolts and boxes of soap. He pointed to the ceiling. "It is called an appartement," he'd said, exaggerating the French pronunciation, as he led me up the stairs at the back of the shop. "In England, they call them flats, but I prefer the European term. They're everywhere in Boston, a very convenient way to live and work." He opened the door then and led me into the second floor home that sat above his place of business. It consists of two small bedrooms and one larger room, combining the kitchen, dining, and living area. His young wife was there, rocking slowly in a chair, lips pursed and brow knotted. Her sour-faced mother sat beside her and held her hand. "It hurts," Grace had told me. "I didn't think it would hurt." "What did you think then?" I asked, kneeling beside her.
"I don't know that I thought much about it all. This part was never explained to me."
I glanced at the girl's mother, the very proper-looking Mrs. Hendricks. "There was no need to alarm my daughter before she was ready." "I tend to think of it as preparing them, not alarming them," I told her. "I have prepared her to be a lady,
Mrs. Hendricks sniffed. Not that you can tell by this backwater village that her husband has chosen. In reality, Grace had only been in the early stages of labor. So early, in fact, that had she been properly educated by her mother about the realities of childbirth, no one would have bothered to call for me until dawn. But I had sat up with the girl regardless, timing her contractions all night. They came every 30 to 45 minutes and lasted 20 seconds. Hardly birth pangs at all. And all the while I listened to Mrs. Hendricks complain about the long, hard journey from Boston, her difficulties on the bad rural roads, and her opinions of them as well. The girl was inexperienced and scared, and when I performed an internal examination, barely dilated. Yet as the night hours dragged on, both Grace and her mother became more intimidated by the process, impatient with the results and doubtful of my ability. At some point, when I slipped out to use the privy, Mrs. Hendricks must have convinced David to send the shop boy for Dr. Page. And now he is here, trying to order me from the room.
"Let me see her,"
Page demands, attempting to edge me away from the bed. "You will not manhandle me," I swat at his arm. "Cross to the other side of the bed if you wish to examine her, but I will not leave my position."
"Very well. I shall have to educate you then."
He turns to Grace.
"It is unfortunate how many country women confuse false labor for the real thing."
"I beg your pardon," I interrupt.
"Because it is obvious. Her pains are now regular and promising, that this is a false labor," he says.
"Oh, for the love of God, Grace, do not listen to this man. I have been with you all night. Your labor is early but real." The girl is of the stiff and straight variety, well-bred and nicely mannered. If not pregnant, she would be slender and shapeless. Excellent posture, tiny waist, nose straight enough to be a ruler. Hair like a pane of glass. Grace Sewell has been bred to look nice in a gown and do as she is told. The problem is that she has always taken her orders from those with a pedigree and a formal education. So it makes sense that when she looks to Dr. Page and his fine coat, she finds comfort and familiarity. Whereas all she has gotten from me during these long hours of the night is an assurance that she must be patient, that the baby will come when it is ready, and that there is nothing to be done in the meantime but wait and walk and sleep if she can. Mrs. Hendricks rises from her chair and joins him at the side of the bed.
"What is your opinion, doctor?"
"I believe," he says, setting his medical bag on the bed beside Grace and unzipping it, "that your daughter is suffering in the way that all women of higher birth suffer."
She waits for him to continue, her eyes round and her mouth curved into a moo of attentiveness, hanging on every word.
"It has been known for centuries that wealthy and beautiful women, those who lead delicate lives and are of an upper strata, such as your daughter, suffer a great deal more during childbirth than," he looks at me, "common women."
"That is absurd," I tell him. "If you knew anything about women, much less birth, you would know the female body works the same regardless of class."
"And how many well-bred women have you delivered, Mistress Ballard? How many ladies or governors' daughters? How many wealthy women have you sat beside?"
Dr. Page does not wait for me to finish drawing the breath that will school him on how many hundreds of women I have delivered, from all walks of life, before he plunges ahead.
"As I thought. Now get out of the way and let me assist this woman so that I may relieve her of these false pains."
"Thank you, doctor,"
Mrs. Hendricks says, voice breathy and submissive.
"What can you do for her?"
"Administer laudanum. She will sleep and her pains will cease."
"Grace," I make my appeal directly to the girl now. "Medical textbooks do suggest laudanum for a false labor. Your labor is still early, but quite real, and this medicine will do you great harm." Dr. Page clenches his jaw. I am confident in my diagnosis.
A diagnosis determined by what? I demand. You have not once checked her, internally or externally.
By observation and medical skill. Remember which of us, he turns to Grace as he finishes, has the medical degree in this room.
Grace looks at her mother, confused and terrified.
What should I do?
Listen to the doctor, darling. He went to school for this.
It is decided then, and I watch in horror as Dr. Page pulls out a bottle filled with reddish-brown liquid.
50 drops ought to do it, he says.
That will knock her unconscious.
How else do you expect her to sleep? You've kept her up the entire night, chattering and performing needless examinations.
Dr. Page pulls out a dropper from a small velvet bag and begins to measure the drops into a tiny goblet.
Here,
he says, after a few moments, handing the cup to Grace.
Drink.
Please do not take that medicine,
I all but yell. But Grace Sewell tips the cup backward and drains the contents into her mouth, shivers at the bitter taste, swallows with a delicate gulp, wipes her mouth with the back of her hand. Within moments, her eyes are heavy, and she is breathing slowly. Dr. Page puts his things away and buckles his bag.
Have her husband call for me when the real pains begin, though I do not expect that to be for some days yet.
I watch him go, but say nothing, as I do not want to discourage his departure. The sooner that fool leaves, the sooner I can care for Grace. Mrs. Hendricks glares at me.
Aren't you leaving as well?
Absolutely not.
Your daughter,
I say, pointing to where the girl lies, sprawled on her back, will soon be deep in the throes of labor. But she has been rendered unconscious by that idiot. It will be a miracle if he hasn't killed her and the child both.
You don't really think that? Of course I damn well do, I shout, and am gratified by the look of horror on Mrs. Hendricks' face as she shrinks backward. Why do you think I argued with him?
I will stay exactly where I am until I know that your daughter and grandchild are well, but if they aren't, you will have Dr. Page to thank for that. Remember that the next time you panic and call a man to do a woman's job.
Grace sleeps for 9 hours. I sit beside her the entire time, fretting, my fingers on the girl's wrist, counting each heartbeat. They are too slow, the contractions too weak, not nearly what is required to press a child into the world. But they do not stop, and that is its own kind of miracle. Finally, Grace begins to sweat. Each contraction hardens her belly, and she moans deep in her throat. It is the kind of sound a soldier makes when he lies near the cusp of death on a battlefield, of a wounded animal in the forest. It is the sound of a woman arriving at transition, that painful shift between labor and birth. At first, it is a panting, then a whistling, followed by a groan from deep inside her chest. If she were awake, I could prepare her for what comes next. When Grace starts to gag, I have only seconds to sit her upright and lean her over before she vomits a foul brown plume onto the bed. Grace is covered. Her clothes are covered. The bedding is covered. But she is finally awake and instantly aware that her body is deep in the work of birthing her child. The voice comes from behind me.
Mrs. Ballard, I... When I look to Mrs. Hendricks, I can see her throat working hard to swallow the apology. She looks away. Can Grace manage the rest of her labor? Stupid, prideful woman, I think.
Yes, but thanks to you, she is no better equipped to handle the next birth. She will only remember the worst of this one, I say, then order her away to gather warm water and clean linens.
What happened?
Grace asks, as the last of the laudanum fades from her system. I believe that you have learned exactly what kind of doctor Benjamin Page truly is.
Now,
I look her directly in the eye as I begin to help her out of the soiled gown. Will you allow me to assist you with a thing that I do best? She nods, swallows, begins to cry.
Yes.
Good. Your mother is bringing us a wash basin, and then we are going to meet your baby. When Dr. Page comes running up the chandlery steps 2 hours later, I meet him at the door to Grace's bedroom. The girl is sitting up in bed, holding her new son with a sense of wonder and pride. When Page tries to push past me, I set a hand on his chest. You are not needed here. That is my— No, she's my patient. You would do well to learn your place, Mistress Ballard. I laugh at him. I have been in my place for many, many hours now. You, on the other hand, knocked a woman unconscious and abandoned her to the ill effects of a dangerous drug. As a result, you were not present when she began to vomit in her sleep. Had I not been in my place, she would have died. But I am curious about one thing, however, I say. He looks in alarm to the bed.
What?
Did you even bother to learn her name while you were gone? Any humility that might have been rising to the surface after learning his error is wiped away by a sudden flash of pride.
There was no need.
Then you have learned nothing. Her name is Grace, and if you were an educated man, as you claim, you would know that the name means unmerited favor, which is exactly what God has shown by allowing both her and the child to survive your ministrations. I close the door in his face. Pollard's Tavern, Saturday, December 12. There is blood in the snow. A crowd has gathered outside the tavern, and two men scuffle at its heart, arms and legs flailing. Amos and Moses Pollard stand on either side of the shrinking circle, arms out to block anyone from interfering. Abigail has wisely situated herself on the front steps, mug of steaming cider in hand, a safe distance from the fray. She looks on with disdain. I have just come from delivering Grace Sewell, and am ready to be home, but my curiosity wins out, and I cross the street to see what all the fuss is about. Men are a right bunch of fools, Abigail mutters when I reach her side. Yes, but which ones specifically? The one that's bleeding is James Wall. Before I can ask a question or jump to any conclusions, she adds, and the other is an officer of the court from Vassalboro. Came here to bring James in on charges, he did. Charges for what? She shrugs. Don't know, but James doesn't want to be brought. So they're deciding it amongst themselves. Like I said, fools. James shouldn't have resist, and the officer shouldn't have let him. Let? You'll see. And I do soon enough, when the officer grows tired of the debacle. He's an average-sized man, under 6 foot, and not so much thin as sinewy. It is clear he's been trained to box, however, and is quick on his feet. A left hook makes contact with James's jaw, sending him sprawling to the frozen mud. The officer is on him in a moment, tying his hands behind his back with a length of rope.
As I said, the officer pants, you are to report to Fort Western immediately to face charges for failure to pay your debts.
James spits a glob of blood onto the ground.
I already told you, we got stuck in the river and couldn't make our delivery. So I didn't get paid, and therefore I couldn't make my payment last month.
The young officer does appear sympathetic at this, but he straightens his back and stands over James.
The why of it is none of my business. That's for the court to decide.
The crowd watches as he pulls James to his feet and leads him to a wagon parked beside the tavern. They step aside as James is hoisted onto the seat and has his bindings tied to an iron loop attached to the wagon's sideboard. It's a sailor's knot, meant for rigging, and there's no chance it will come loose on the journey. Once satisfied that James is secure, the officer unties the reins and climbs to his seat.
He tips his hat to the crowd, then flicks the leather straps and shouts,
"Ha!"
The horse turns onto Water Street and toward the north as the residents of the Hook stare silently after them.
"He lodged here last night," Abigail says, preempting my question again. "Said his name was Barnabas Lambert, but we didn't know he was an officer of the court or why he come.
He looks to be quite young."
"Aye, about 20, I'd say. And that probably worked in his favor."
"How's that?"
"Moses told me he was asking around about James, where he lives and what he looks like. Everyone thought they must be old acquaintances. But it was the horse he was most interested in."
Abigail takes a sip of her cider and turns to me.
"Why?" "A man's a man, but every horse is unique. That's what he told Moses, at any rate. And 'tis well known that James rides a Narragansett pacer. He boasts of it often enough. Says it comes from Washington's own herd." "Lies, probably. I couldn't have picked one out of a herd, mind you, but that officer could. Charged right out of the tavern the moment he saw James tie up at the post."
I look to where the horse stands beside the hitching post, confused and jittery thanks to all the excitement. It's of middling height with narrow hindquarters, and like so many other horses, is a warm chestnut brown. Black mane, black tail, black socks. The head and tail are held high, though, and I think that maybe a good horseman would know a pacer from a hackney.
"What will you do with it?" I ask, nodding to the horse. "Board him, I guess. James can settle the bill later."
The wagon is gone now, but I look in the direction it left. I thought debtor's prison was a thing of the past. How much does James owe?
Abigail shrugs. "There wasn't much opportunity for asking questions once the punches started flying, was there? But I have heard James intends to start a distillery."
She turns those moss-green Scottish eyes on me, gives me a look filled with import.
"And that he went to Judge North for the loan."
"Why him?"
"A wealthy man is North, likes to have a finger in every pot. Or so I'm told."
I turn my head to the side, take in the hulking form of the tavern behind us. "Has Amos?"
"He would never."
The crowd starts to disperse, and I see John Cowan, the young blacksmith's apprentice, saunter over to say a few words to the Pollards' oldest daughter, Catherine. We observe the pair in silence, bowed heads, low voices. At one point, John leans closer and lightly touches Catherine's elbow when she says something. They both laugh, blush. Then he says goodbye and walks away.
"And what do you make of that?"
Abigail asks. Once again, she sips her cider, then passes the mug to me. It's good and rich, tart and strong. I swirl it around my mouth, carefully choosing my words. John is kind and hardworking. Charles Clark depends on him greatly. He's strong, responsible.
But?
I didn't say but.
Not out loud, you dinna.
I flash Abigail a quick smile. He's a good man, I believe that. But not the brightest I've ever known.
Your standards might be too high, Mistress Ballard. Not every man can be Ephraim.
She looks at me with a smile of her own.
Or Amos?
Sadly, no.
You ken my meaning. If he was to come knocking on your door, would you let him court Hannah?
Abigail and I have never discussed Moses's interest in my daughter, but it can't have escaped her notice. It isn't John Cowan who plans to come knocking. Or at least if he did, your own Moses would knock him down. We assess John's retreating form. It wouldn't be a fair fight, but neither of us say it aloud. We both like Moses too much.
Aye, he would try,
Abigail says with a rueful twist of her mouth. Regardless, Hannah appears to be spoken for, and Dolly is still a bit young for courting. But if the circumstances were different on either count, yes, I would open the door for John Cowan.
and I believe Ephraim would as well.
That's about how I reckon things, but I wanted to make sure, Abigail says.
Then as I turn to go, she reaches for her mug.
Martha?
Yes? I hand it back.
Dinna be surprised if Moses comes knocking a bit sooner than ye expect.
I set my quill on the desk and stretch my hand. It aches from cold and age, and the strain of small muscles put to work guiding a child into this world. Friday, December 11. Birth. David Sewell's son. Cloudy. At Mr. Sewell's. I was called to attend Grace Sewell yesterday evening. Her travail was mild, but she and her mother were intimidated and called Dr. Page, who gave my patient 50 drops of laudanum, which put her into such a stupor that her pains, which were regular and promising, became scant until she puked. Her pains returned, and she was delivered at the 7th hour of a son, her firstborn. I received 12 shillings as a reward, left her cleverly at 10, and walked across the river. Cyrus and young Ephraim have long since crawled into their beds on the second floor, and I can hear their snores rattling down the stairwell. The girls have also retreated to their room and whatever dreams the night might bring. Jonathan, as usual, is sleeping elsewhere. My brows pinch together in frustration at the thought of him, but I continue writing. Saturday, December 12. Clear and cold. James Wall was carried to Fort Western by an officer today. I hear a charge was given against him for failure to pay debts. I stretch my back, listening to the wind in the pines and the creak of the house as it settles around me. I can hear a coyote yipping in the pasture and an owl hooting near the barn. The fact of the matter is that I am lonely. And then I laugh. If anyone had told me 2 decades ago, when I was buried in small children and endless chores, that one day I would sit at my desk in a warm, quiet house while the snow fell outside and complain of loneliness, I would have slapped them. That future seemed as far away as Constantinople. I blow a long, cool breath over the new entry to set the ink, then put aside my quill. I would very much like to join the rest of the house in slumber, but I can already feel the creeping wakefulness that often assails me at night. This is a new affliction, something that began once I rounded the corner of 45. I never understood what a gift sleep was until it vanished. Whereas in all the decades before, I slept deep and heavy, soaking up every morsel of rest that was offered. I now skim the surface, fitful, easily woken, and unable to drift off again. On nights like this, no amount of physical exhaustion can induce my mind to shudder. So I read by candlelight instead. It is the only time I allow myself this indulgence. The joy of falling into another life, another world, is the one thing that mitigates the frustration of a sleepless night. I change into my nightgown, brush my hair, slip under the covers, and reach for the candle on the bedside table. I scoot it closer, then open Emmeline by Charlotte Turner Smith. Ephraim purchased the novel on his last trip to Boston. The cover is tattered. I am not the first owner, but the print is clear. And there are no missing pages, which is more than I can say for most of the novels I'm able to get my hands on. Within seconds, I am immersed in a make-believe world of English aristocracy. But it does not escape my attention that, had my own ancestors enjoyed such comfort, I would be living across the sea, and not here in the vast wilds of the New World. Ballard's Mill, Sunday, December 13. The house smells of dead animal, like hide and fat and wild game. The acrid scent will last for several days, but there's no help for that. The deer tallow is pungent, but once it has been made into candles and cured, the stench will fade. I have added dried, crushed lavender and rosemary, along with their oils, to each of the 4 rendering pots that sit on my work table. In a week, the candles will simply smell like the forest, and the house will smell of home once more. There, Dolly says, tying the last of the linen threads to the end of a slender foot-long branch. 240. I inspect her work, then nod in approval. Dolly tied the wicks while I readied the hardening racks along the edge of the room. Each branch will hold 2 candles, and each rack will hold 48. Altogether, we should have enough candles to get through the winter, with extra for bartering. We spent all morning rendering the deer fat given to us by Amos Pollard, then straining it until the tallow was smooth and pale. Dolly and I both wear aprons to keep the oily spatters off our clothes, and scarves around our hair to keep it from falling in our eyes. Candle making is hard, sweaty work, and not a task meant to make a woman look pretty. It is, however, one of the necessary parts of running a household. We take our spots at the table and lower the first branches so that the wicks on either end drop into separate pots. The thick linen strings soak up the wax for a moment before we lift them out again. It takes a few seconds for the rendered fat to harden, and then we plunge them in again. We repeat the process, watching each candle grow in width with every immersion. Once they are an inch wide, we set the branches across a drying rack so that the candles dangle as they harden. The task will take several hours to complete, but neither of us minds. Rarely do we get an entire day together. It is one of those winter afternoons that is so bright the sun reflects off the snow and hurts my eyes if I look at it directly. I cannot help but worry about Ephraim working his way through the frozen marsh up north. His people are Welsh, but have lived in the colonies for 2 generations and have grown acclimated to these northeastern winters. He insists that he no longer feels the cold. I know that he's lying, but he says it anyway. It's the game we play, a dance of concern and denial. Hannah has been with Lucy, our oldest, married daughter, and her family on the other side of the river, near Fort Western, all week. Lucy had her 7th child, Hannah's namesake, earlier in the year, and was eager for both her help and her company. There are 11 years between them, but they have always had a special bond. And now that Hannah is nearing the age of marriage herself, I suspect there are questions she would rather ask her sister. This reality makes me a bit uneasy, however, given Lucy's casual attitude toward things of a carnal nature. Her first child was born a mere 5 months after her wedding. There are rules and rituals, of course, for young people and how they court. Usually it begins at one of the seasonal frolics. Just last month, May Kimball's family hosted one, and there will be another in January here at the mill. But still, young people always find ways to be together, away from watchful eyes. And any time my children are out of sight, I wonder what they might be up to. As for the boys, young Ephraim has joined his older brothers in cutting trees in the forest today, and none of them will be home until dinner. Only Dolly and I are here, and it is both restful and strange. It seems as though only yesterday I had a baby on each hip and 2 more wrapped around my ankles. I plunge the candles into the tallow, then pull them out again, watching the excess drip off and back into the pot. The rendered fat has cooled slightly and isn't as runny, making the process go faster. And I like the way the dried herbs speckle the tallow. But I keep an eye on the consistency, because if it gets much thicker, the pots will need to go back over the fire. We work in companionable silence until Dolly says, "I took stew and bread to Mistress Foster yesterday while you were out." "And is she well?" I ask. "No better," Dolly says. "No worse." Ever since Sally Pierce made her accusations, the Fosters' world has grown increasingly small. Many of those inclined to defend them now whisper behind their backs. They wonder. They gossip. Some neighbors avoid them altogether. Few in the Hook cared that Joshua Burgess was dead until their pastor was incriminated in his murder. And those who dismissed Rebecca's claim of being raped look at her askance now that she is pregnant. I am thinking about what I might do for Rebecca when Dolly points at something out the window.
Who is that? She asks.
It's a simple question, but there is a curiosity, a certain kind of light in her eyes, that I note before turning to the window. A man has driven his wagon up to the garden gate and dismounted. He is young and agile, of average height, and I recognize him immediately.
That is Barnabas Lambert.
I've never heard the name. He's an officer of the court from Vassalboro. Dolly finishes dipping her candles, sets the branch on the hardening rack, then moves to the window for a better look. She fists her hands on her hips and gives the man a curious stare, head cocked to the side, lips pursed. Why would an officer of the court come here?
An excellent question, I say. You keep working on the candles. I'll find out.
My tallow has gone thick, she says.
And I know she wants to come along. By the faint smile tugging at the edge of her mouth, I suspect that Dolly might find the young man attractive.
Then melt it again. I'll be back shortly. I keep my apron on and the scarf around my head when I go to greet Mr. Lambert. I pull the front door open before he has made it through the garden gate. He tips his hat.
Good morning, Mistress
Ballard.
Good morning, Mistress Ballard.
I know who you are, Mr. Lambert. He stops on the path, chin tilted to the side, an expression on his face that suggests he's trying to remember if we have met.
You do?
I saw you apprehend James Wall and the Hook yesterday. He takes off the wide-brimmed felt cap and whacks it against his leg twice, even though it isn't dusty.
Ah, then you won't be surprised to hear that I've come to arrest someone else.
I like James, and still think it unfair that a measly debt could land him in jail, so I can't keep the snide tone out of my voice when I reply, someone forget to pay their taxes? Or perhaps you're after a gossip. There, I've almost made him smile, but it doesn't quite reach the surface.
A bit more serious than that, I'm afraid. I'm here to arrest a man accused of rape.
You've come for Joseph North. He shakes his head, and a single curl flops onto his forehead and falls across his eye. It makes him look younger somehow, less serious. He shoves it away with the back of his hand.
No, I'm here for Joshua Burgess.
He doesn't know. How is that possible?
Well, Joshua Burgess doesn't live here, I hedge.
So I gathered, but now I'm known in town after what happened yesterday, and it's always best to have the element of surprise when coming to arrest a man. I halfway expect him to have fled anyway. I thought I'd stop and ask the neighbors first.
And you just happened upon us.
You are the first drive off the main road into town.
He hooks one thumb over his shoulder and points north.
At least coming from Vassalboro.
Well, I say, taking comfort in the coincidence, I know for a fact that Burgess hasn't fled.
But are you willing to tell me where he is?
I pull the corner of my bottom lip into my mouth, thinking, if you'll tell me something in exchange.
And what would that be?
Why you haven't come for Joseph North.
Ah, I see.
Barnabas scratches the back of his neck.
Direct orders from the court. I'm to let North come in on his own for the hearing.
And why does he get different treatment?
Because he's a judge. And a colonel.
James Wall was a captain, and you arrested him in front of 20 people. He nods once, but doesn't break eye contact.
There's a wide gap between captain and colonel, isn't there?
And a wide gap in favor, too, I'd say. You think that is fair?
What I think has nothing to do with it. I'm only an officer of the court. No one asks my opinion.
I just did. He flashes a quick, bright smile.
I think that I've a single job, mistress. to apprehend the men I'm ordered to. And I'm the sort of man who does my job.
Yesterday, when he was scuffling with James, I hadn't gotten a good look at him. But I take Barnabas in now, curious about this man who has stepped into the scandal enfolding our town. He has sandy-colored hair and eyes that might be hazel, or perhaps brown. I can't tell from this distance. But there's something about his face and the way he moves that makes him appear unremarkable. It occurs to me that perhaps he does this on purpose, to seem non-threatening. He's young to be an officer of the court, and looking nondescript, especially to strangers, would be an advantage.
"Your turn," he says. "I've answered your questions."
"You can find Joshua Burgess at Pollard's Tavern." He flicks a glance to the house behind me, then back, another smile quirking the corner of his mouth.
"Seems to be a popular place amongst the criminal element in your town."
"James isn't a criminal," I say. "He's a friend, in fact. And there isn't a man in this town who wasn't shocked to hear that he's failed to pay a debt."
Abashed, Barnabas nods once. It's not an apology. He doesn't owe me one. But rather an acknowledgement that he's misjudged the man.
"Go to the tavern. Ask for Amos Pollard. Tell him I sent you. He'll take you to Burgess."
"I thank you for the help," he says, replacing his hat.
He tips it, adds,
"Mistress?"
Then looks over my shoulder. Again he offers that charming smile and tips his hat a second time.
"Miss?"
I turn to find Dolly leaning in the doorway, hand on her hip, scarf conspicuously missing from her hair. She watches Barnabas with an expression that I can only describe as proprietary.
"Well, that's new."
"Good day to you, Mr. Lambert,"
I say, walking to the garden gate to see him off. He unties the reins and climbs onto the wagon seat. Another tip of his hat, another glance over my shoulder, a smile that twitches at the corner of his mouth, and then he's gone, unaware of the gruesome discovery awaiting him at the tavern. Dolly comes down the walkway to my side.
"Why didn't you tell him?"
"About Burgess?"
"Yes."
"Because he'd have gone back to Vesselboro."
"That's a bad thing? If he goes home now, he'll never see the body. And if he never sees that body, he won't ask any questions about how Joshua Burgess came to be hanged, then thrown in the river."
I look Dolly full in the face and see the vivid flash of understanding in her eyes.
"I want as many people asking questions as possible."
"I think he will," Dolly says, with a firm nod. She turns her gaze down the drive to where Barnabas and his wagon have already disappeared into the trees.
"He seems clever."
It's a woman that does the choosing. I remember Ephraim's statement from a few days ago. Anyone who thinks differently is a fool. Tuesday, December 15. Clear and cold. I have been at home. Made 20 dozen candles. An officer went by here looking for Captain Burgess with a warrant for his arrest.